Civil Undoubted Practices Committee to order. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of February 26th? Representative Johnson moves the minutes of February 26th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. Representative Lean, please come forward. Where did you go? We're going to go ahead and go with you first because Representative Detmer is not here. So please come to the table, bring your testifiers, and let's roll. Representative Hillstrom, would you like to move House File 733 and have it with the motion to have it referred to the Committee on Higher Education?
Yes, Madam Chair, I think it's 773.
What did I say, 733?
Uh-huh.
I'm dyslexic.
And where is it going?
Higher ed.
Okay, and Madam Chair, I would move the DE1 amendment
right.
to get the bill in the shape the author would like.
Okay. Both the bill and the amendment are before us. Representative Lean, go ahead and why don't you explain the amendment first and what it does.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you, Representative Hillstrom. The bill is basically opening up contracts that MNSCU enters with outside consultants, mandating that the Board of Trustees must make these contracts transparent, basically have to disclose the terms, conditions, identity of the consultant, and the nature of any analysis or advice that the contractor or the consultant gives to MNSCU. The DE amendment does put a $1 million threshold so that any contract with an outside consultant above $1 million will fall under these terms. The board would have to post the consultant's work or the contract within 30 days after the contract is agreed to or entered into. Also, this contract must be an item on the board's agenda at their next board meeting, so they would have to actually discuss the contract in public. And I drafted this amendment to provide more public, I drafted this bill to provide more public transparency on the operations and governance of MNSCU, of which MNSCU is a public institution using public dollars to educate over 400,000 students across the state. And this does fall in line with the existing Board of Trustees policy requiring board approval of consultant contracts over $1 million. And so I wanted to draft this bill to fall in line with that policy, but also to go a step further in transparency by requiring this disclosure become statute, become law. And with me today, I have Cody Meyer, who's the Student Senate President at Minnesota State University Moorhead, to talk about the bill from a student's perspective.
Thank you, Representative Lean. Why don't we discuss the amendment first? Do members have any questions regarding the DE-1? Representative Grunhagen, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Lean, for bringing this forward. Why did you come up with $1 million?
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen. Again, that's I initially had it that it would be any contract that the board would enter into, and I brought it to that $1 million level again to make it in line with existing board policy. But also, I didn't want to get into some smaller contracts that they may enter into for things that may have to do with negotiations between faculty, those types of things. And so that $1 million threshold to me seemed to be a pretty good number, that this is going to be really some pretty significant contracts that are going to really have a lot of bearing on future operations, future governance of the system.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, thank you for that response, Representative Lean. I just, it just seems a little high to me. Our K-12 system, when I was on the board, I think 50,000 was the limit. So I think you want to have a minimum floor to avoid getting into the smaller contracts, And maybe 50,000 is too low in the MNSCU University system, but I guess I'd like to see a little bit more verification and rationale why, you might have a lot of contracts coming in at $999,999.99. Not being skeptical how the system works, but it does seem to. Human nature being what it is, it gets a little devious at times. But I guess I'd like to see a little more rationale why a million is, and also my preference would be to reduce that sum. So those are just, if you want to respond to any of that, those are just some of my initial thoughts.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Grunhagen. You know, I'm certainly open to suggestions. Like I say, I initially did have it to be any contract that the system enters into with the consultant. I brought that million-dollar threshold up after talking with some folks. Right now, there are, of course, some conversations with the system and faculty about, some differences they have. And I, without getting too much into the higher education issues, a lot of these differences, I drafted this bill as a way to preempt some of these differences, some of these points of contention from coming up in the future. So thinking that if we had a bill like this in place, we could have a little more conversation between the system and faculty in the future. And so in talking with that, I learned that, you know, in order to protect some of the privacy of those conversations, some of the privacy of those negotiations, that million-dollar threshold was a good number to go. You know, if folks want to have further conversation, further discussion about that threshold, you know, I'm certainly open to this as the bill moves through the process, certainly open to any additional committee work, any additional work the legislature wants to put in this bill. But like I say, that, you know, is a starting point, and it does fall in line with that existing board policy on that million-dollar threshold.
Representative Lean, just curious. I guess I tend to agree with Representative Grunhagen that I think million is pretty high. But I had a question also for staff, and that is, why isn't this already considered public information in light of Timber J? Representative, or Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, members, so this bill doesn't change the data classification of the contract. It's correct that the contracts that Minsky enters into are subject to the data practices disclosure requirements. What this bill and this amendment is doing is sort of extending that a little bit further, requiring sort of proactive notice of the existence of the contract. I think there have been some examples of some contracts that Minsky has entered in the past that weren't sort of they were public data, but nobody necessarily knew that they existed to know to ask about them. Mm-hmm. So what this bill is really doing is requiring the public posting on the board's website and discussion at the board's meeting, which is sort of step further than what Chapter 13 requires right now.
Okay, thank you for that. And again, Representative Lean, I would like to see that number lower. I know we don't need to know what the Pepsi Man contract is and those sorts of things, so we don't need to get down maybe into the weeds that far, but I think a million is awfully high. Representative Lesch is next on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gehring, for that explanation. That is my question, too. It's really not a question about whether we're protecting privacy of these contracts at all, because they are public. The legislature made clear in 1999 that they were explicitly public, and then we went through 15 years of that going on, well, 13 years. In November 13, the Supreme Court came through, tried to mask some of it because of contractual language restructuring, and then we made clear last year that, no, by the way, we really did mean what we said. All of this is public for the outsourcing of a contract and the outsourcing of a subcontract. So what we pay the Pepsi man is public information, too. I guess my question is, when you're talking about an affirmative disclosure, the act of affirmative disclosure, the only reason not to completely compel the university to be forthright about how they're spending the public money is their arguments about maybe there are administrative hurdles to disclosing all of that. Do we have to hire a person to put this all this stuff out? Well, I don't know if we have someone from Minsky here today, but it would only be the words from someone from Minsky who would persuade me not to say no, there should be no limit, no million-dollar limit. It should be set at zero, because this is all public under Chapter 13. There's no reason for them to not disclose it, unless they say, "Well, we got it." I mean, you got to understand, we'd have to hire a team of people to pore over this and learn and determine how we disclose it, which might potentially be legitimate. But is there anyone here from Minsky today, Madam Chair, who intends to testify on this?
I'm wondering, is there anyone here from Minsky? I don't see the regular cast of characters, but doesn't look like there is somebody. Representative Lean.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. I did speak with Minsky about this bill yesterday. They had told me they were neutral on it. They did not indicate whether they would be here to testify on the bill, though.
Madam Chair, we run into this problem a couple times in this committee where we're intending to deal with a bill that affects a certain department or agency, and then they don't show up to testify. And it makes it really difficult for us to get a sense of where we need to be at. So in my opinion, stomp through and scare the snakes out of the grass. You don't need to put $1 million limit in there to say hopefully it's okay with Minsky. If they don't see fit to come in and have an opinion on this bill, I don't think there should be a DE-1 amendment on it. And then maybe they'll show up and and argue why we shouldn't do this. I mean, that's kind of the way we do things around here. So that's just my opinion, Madam Chair. I would hope we would take the DE-1 amendment off.
Thank you. Representative Johnson has a question.
Madam Chair, Representative Lean, in your testimony you talked about faculty and some of the faculty negotiations and contracts. It's my understanding that these employees are public and their salaries and stuff are public information. So I'm not sure why the faculty would be involved in this particular bill. Sure. These are subcontracted out contracts that we're talking about here. And I also agree that $1 million is extremely high. From your testimony, you said it was the Minsky board came up with this $1 million on their own. But how many contracts don't we know about that are under $100 million mark that because they don't post them and we don't know about them, that we might actually want to look at it and wonder why they're doing that?
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Representative Johnson, you do bring up a good point, and you know I don't necessarily want to be in a position here defending that $1 million threshold from Minsky's perspective. My intent of this bill is to provide as much disclosure, as much transparency as possible with contracts the system enters into without outside consultants dealing with governance, dealing with operations, basically the future direction of the system, as I say it. It's a public institution with public dollars educating 410,000 students across the state. So that's really my biggest intent of the bill, my biggest goal of the bill. I think the DE-1 amendment is important in regards to the fact that it would mandate the disclosure of the contract be posted on the system's website. And in addition to just disclosure at a board meeting, that it's actually an agenda for conversation at a board meeting. So, you know, I personally would like to see the DE amendment stay on for those reasons. You know, like I say, if folks, as this moves through the committee process, if other folks want to see that threshold dropped, I'm certainly open to that conversation, certainly open to working on that aspect of the bill. So I guess I'll leave it at that.
Representative Lean, I'm just wondering if you would be agreeable to... These are out of order because we're doing things. First, my menu. On line 1.9, would you be amenable to just removing from the word worth $1 million and or? And I would want to make sure that that's okay with the rest of the committee. We didn't obviously have this on our agenda for 24 hours. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the deference to the bill author, but in my opinion, at least at this point, I would even vote to take that language out over the author's objections because I want to put him in a good position. And I have a serious problem here with not having Minsky saying anything about this in committee. And I realize it's going to leave this committee, but I don't want to put other committees in the same position. So absence their input, I think it would be important for this committee to take that out, the words you said, worth $1 million or more. So I would move that as a motion, Madam Chair.
Okay, it has been moved by Representative Lesh to take out worth $1 million or more, I guess, is the actual language that we would be removing. Discussion on the amendment to the amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The amendment to the amendment is adopted. Now we will have the DE1 before us, the amended DE1. All those in favor of passing the DE1 amendment as amended, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All the opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Before we move on to the testifier, well, actually, why don't we move on to your testifier, Representative Lean, and then I think Mr. Neumeister has some comments, too, or he wants to testify. Go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, good morning. It is a privilege to address the committee, and I appreciate your time greatly. My name is Cody Meyer. I'm student body president at Minnesota State University Moorhead, and I also sit on the board of directors for the Minnesota State University Student Association, collectively with the board representing all the four-year universities at the Minsky system. However, today I'm not wearing any of those hats, and in this testimony, I'm appealing to you as a student of the Minsky system and as a concerned citizen in the state of Minnesota. However, with that being said, if the committee will indulge me, I'm accompanied today by a few members of my team who could make it today, and I would like, at your discretion, to quickly introduce them.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Today with me, I have Mr. Sean Duckworth, the Legislative and Internal Affairs Chair for MSUM Student Senate, Megan Parks, Secretary, MSUM Student Senate, and Kelsey Slattery, off-campus residential senator of the MSUM Student Senate. I'm very pleased to be with you today. As I address you today, I will, in dialogue, readdress you in affairs of which I'm confident you're well aware. The reality of the situation is that I'm here to address you in relation of which you are far more qualified than myself, and yet we still find ourselves engaged nonetheless. The amendments to the statute reaffirm a commitment to an ethical standard that should be assumed of any institution governed by the state of Minnesota. However, a standard of understanding between the Minsky system and its stakeholders has been breached, and student trust in that understanding has been broken. While I reserve myself to generalities about the current climate of things, the statute has brought a phenomenal amount of discord to our respective student associations, and actions of which a large population of the student associations find completely unacceptable. There is, and reasonably should be, a dissemination of information on consultant work, regardless of the nature of the work or the amount paid. There needs to be a clear channel of information and transparency between the system and the students that call that system home. In my capacity as a representative of students, my ability to accurately represent students becomes impeded when that channel of information is disrupted. I am unable to do my job, and with that end in mind, I would argue neither can you. The chief revenue source of the Minsky system are student tuition dollars and state support, and in the current academic year, I have wrestled with the fact that I can't answer a fundamental question of governance. Where is my money going? You don't have to dig far into recent events to understand the size and scope of this problem. I, as a representative, cannot explain where several million dollars of my students' money is going, and the scope of the problem is deeper still. I'll remind you that there is, until further evidence prevails, money received both from student dollars and from the taxpayers of Minnesota in some of the current initiatives. These are your constituents, and they are my own. But collectively, we cannot answer the question of what this money is buying. For me, it brings a lack of faith in my leadership and competency. But if you fail to answer this question during election season, it could cost an election. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, Madam Chair, the statute needs revision. And while the statute aims to address a problem that never should have been, in your discretion lies the opportunity to assure that it never happens again. Again, thank you for your time and consideration, and I end my testimony with the words of Abraham Lincoln. You cannot escape the responsibility of tomorrow by evading it today.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. I do have a question to either you or the author, the bill's author. When you have guest lecturers come in, I'm assuming that's under contract as well. Representative Lean?
Madam Chair, I guess I'm not for certain. I would assume so.
Just wondering, I know a few years ago there was a rather controversial speaker that came to Moorhead State that maybe caught the taxpayers off guard. Thank you for your testimony. Any other questions for the testifier? Okay, seeing none, Mr. Neumeister, go ahead and grab you a chair here and you can... Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. One of the reasons why this bill is before you is because of a $2 million plus of taxpayer money was used for a consultant's report on Minsky called done by the McKinsey & Company. And what happened all last summer, this was a big issue. In other words, people were being denied the information. When some press got involved, led by the Pioneer Press, they got the report because it was completely how to reorganize under a theme of Minsky. A lot of it was redacted. All considered trade secrets, as Don Gemberling said in the paper, in the newspaper article, there's no way that it should be treated as trade secret. So that is one of the main factors of why we're here today, because some of your colleagues got upset about that, and it still continues. So another aspect of this, words are important. And words, when you try to extend it to say, put it on the website, can sometimes be used by government to say, even though it's public, they're not going to give it to you until it's on the website. And so this is how I'm analyzing this bill. The words on line 1-8, to the extent that, is one of the great words that's used. I'm sorry, Mr. Neumeister, it's public and all that, but we're not going to do it until, or we're not going to put it on the website or whatever. That is the words that people use to not to avoid the disclosure on the website. So my suggestion is take those language out and put when the board, so it's very clear. So you, to the extent that is taken out, and when. I agree that the threshold is too high. Now you got to remember that when you're saying it's not going to be every contract, it's only going to be those contracts that are professional consultant to provide advice or to analyze matters to system operations and the governance. So it's really defined, and it's basically more of organization type things. It's not going to be dealing with the Pepsi contract or whatever. Now, the other aspect of this on lines 116, the disclosure must be posted on the board's website. Now, what might happen, and as Madam Chair, as you and Representative Lesh know so well with the Timber Jay deal and also with discussion here, it's already public. But what can happen is now, you know, this is focused to put this on the website, but how someone might read this. If, let's say, I know there's a contract, it's already been signed, I go to the Minsky, Mankato, wherever, they're all over the state, I want to look at the contract. Oh, I'm sorry, but it's not posted on the website yet, and we haven't disclosed it on the website, so it's not public. So I want to be very clear, because this is how people, when you pass your laws, our laws, which is all of ours, Minnesota laws, citizens and policymakers, residents, policymakers, is how people read them. So those are three points that I think that are important. And the final point on the effective date. I think, and I was just reading the article, and I was going to try and get copies, but the printer is not working upstairs to give it to you in terms of the legislative reference library. But that $2 million contract, which has all been blanked out with 123 pages, still not available to the public in terms of unredacted. So somehow, some way, because this was the genesis of why this bill is here, maybe you might want to look at forcing that to be disclosed, because that has been the heartache, as Representative Lean could tell you, that's driving this and is still driving it with students, faculty, and all that. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you very much, and I've given you some suggestions.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister, and those are good suggestions. And Representative Lean, I would, you know, put it out there that it might be a good idea to talk to Mr. Neumeister to tighten up the language of this before it goes to the next committee. Any final comments, Representative?
Madam Chair and members, duly noted. I wish I had been able to speak to Mr. Neumeister before the committee hearing, but. You know, I think just the fact that students from Moorhead drove down on a day like today, mm-hmm. as far as the conditions, really speaks to how important this bill is for the future of the system and ultimately the future of the state. And so I do appreciate your time to hear the bill today and your indulgence to work on it in committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lean. Representative Hilstrom renews her motion to pass House File 773 as amended. and be referred to the Committee on Higher Education. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. 773 is on its way to higher ed. Thank you, Representative Lean.
Thank you.
Representative Lomer, I still don't see Representative Detmer in the audience. Oh! Welcome to the committee, Representative Detmer. I was just getting ready to say, I hope that, you know, you were okay.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I was sitting in another committee, State Government Finance, and thank you for sending Paige down to get me.
Yes, go ahead.
I could have said I was sitting here all the time, but...
Actually, we need to get your bill before the committee. I will move House File 546 and have it be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Go ahead, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. House File 546 basically is to help solve a problem that we have right now in the state. If we take a look at our military records, especially the personnel records, the DD-214 and DD-215, which pretty much outlines your career that you served in the military, are kept at the county recorder, and in which they are filed. Many veterans, when they need the information, may not recall which county that recorded in. Now, myself, and I tell people that are serving, always make copies of everything that's given to you by the military. Keep your own files. But many times, files are not kept, and when veterans need to get some benefits, they need to show their DD-214 or DD-215. Now, the county recorders and county veteran service officers, in conjunction with the State Department of Veterans Affairs Services, Veteran Services, have been working on a solution to help locate the records quickly and efficiently so veterans can receive their certified copy. And it needs to be a certified copy, which is needed to receive certain services and benefits. All 87 counties invested into a proprietary computer system that helps locate which county a couple's marriage certificate is filed in. And what we're saying here is that that same system can be used to locate our military records. Using the same system, an internal database is being created for searching statewide to help county service officers locate which county their DD-214, DD-215 were filed in, which avoids current situation where they may have to call every county to find out where they are located. And so the information will be confidential, only viewable by the CVCO, the County Service Veteran Service Officer, doing the search. So the problem is the state law is not clear that the searching of the data is allowable. County recorders, county veteran service officers, and the State Department of Veteran Services consulted with the DVA legal counsel to get the clarification. So the solution then, Madam Chair, is to modify the statute to make it clear that the location of the county in which the document is filed is allowed and shared between the government entities. This will ensure that the internal database can be used for the CVSOs to locate the correct county quickly and get certified copies in hands of the veterans and their families as quickly as possible so they can access their benefits. And I have a testifier here, Kay Workley, would like to add some comments.
Okay. Go ahead and state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Representative Scott, committee. My name is Kay Rokey. I'm the Martin County Recorder in Fairmont, and I'm representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers. The military DD-214, the military discharge paper, is recorded in the county recorder's office, generally in the county where the veteran was born or had lived for an extended period of time, but not necessarily. It can be filed in any of the counties in the state. The reason that it's recorded in the county recorder's office is because it's a permanent record, and as we do with land records, it's preserved and it's retrievable. When the veteran is looking for benefits or has deceased and the spouse or their family is looking for benefits and they need to find the DD-214, there are a lot of difficulties locating that throughout the state. So working with the Veterans Association and the VA and the County Recorders Association, and working with this similar type of index, which is very minimal amount of data in the system, we came to a conclusion that this would work very well for the veteran, the VSOs, to locate these records throughout the state. The issue then, of course, became when we were looking at the statute 196. We found out that, or we felt that it needed to have a little more clarification on having it delivered to one government entity to another. These are private records. They're restricted in our county record offices, and they are not for public use. And this database, or this index that we're working with, is only for the veteran service officers. The recorder's offices cannot access it, and it is only for the use of the VSOs. So we have worked with the groups to come up with some language that just basically clarifies how we would pass this information back and forth for them to get the certified copy of the DD-214. So with that clarity, we hope that you will pass this law on.
Thank you. Representative Lesch has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Detmer. I think I understand the reasons for this, and I appreciate you constantly repeating to people to keep their own files and records. To folks who have not served in the military, have no idea how absolutely ridiculous it can get. Imagine the worst bureaucracy of trying to obtain a service or benefit, and then being put through the ringer multiple times because you don't have the right form and filled out in the right way. So when you've been out of the service for 20 years and all of a sudden you find you're in need of those services which your country promised you when you put yourself in harm's way, you don't remember where you put this stuff. So having to track down is pretty important. So thank you for bringing this. That said, the language strikes me as really broad. And I just wonder if there is a way to do this exactly what you're trying to do, namely putting it under the purview of being trackable by VSOs or someone more specifically, but any government employee or entity within a government entity or another employee, for the purposes of performance of official duties or to another government entity for the purposes of locating records. You know, I'm just speculating here, but let's say we were at a time in this country like the early 1970s where there was overwhelmingly anti-veteran sentiment and people were concerned about the activities of veterans. Would it allow a government that was maybe hostile to veterans' interests to track down all these veterans via their DD-214s and track out and find out where they were? Or does it only matter insofar as this would allow us to find out where that record is? I'm concerned about the breadth of the language, and am I just misreading this?
Go ahead,
Madam Chair, this committee. The DD-214 is in a restricted database. This index that we're referring to has very limited information in it. It will only have the name and the date of birth because of the issue of Johnson's and Anderson's, and the date of discharge. That's all the and the county where it's located at, and that's all the information that is in that database. It is only accessible through the VSOs and not in through any other source.
And is it, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair,
Representative Lesch.
I think it's my understanding, too, that the information, Madam Chair and Representative Lesch, I think my understanding, too, is that the only information that would be accessible is the date of birth, the name of the person, but the information on the DD-214 is not available. The whole purpose of this is just to be able to locate where it's at. That's my understanding.
Representative Lesch.
Okay, that answers that question for me. And then the second question is it in the statute? Where does it say it is just limited to VSOs? Because it says here any government employee or official for the performance of official duties.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch.
Ms. Roque.
It doesn't state in here, but when we worked with the VA and the VSOs, that we have come up with the system. We have the specs already in place for it, and by working with them, we have an agreement with them that it is only in an internal database for their use only. There's no reason that we can use it, and so it isn't written in statute, but yet it is in agreement with them.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, Ms. Rhodes, I think that's fine. Just, you know, around here, when someone comes in and says, don't worry about it, that's our practice, a lot of times we'll make it statutory just in case. I don't think maybe that's necessary in this instance, but thank you for your answer.
Representative Detmer, I was just visiting with House Research here and said, do we need to put that agreement that your testifier just spoke of into the statute? And he said it would be helpful so that it's just really clear who has access to the data and who doesn't and what data is accessible. So would you be willing to work, Representative Detmer, before the next committee and with House Research to get some language?
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, yes. We can do that. We
Great.
Can do that. Thank
Great.
You, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. With that, any further discussion from the members? Seeing none, all those in favor of House File 546 being passed and re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance, please signify by saying yes. Yes?
Yes.
Aye. Yeah. Same side of your post. Your bill, House File 546, is on its way to Committee on State Government Finance. Thank you so much for being
Thank
here.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you. Representative Lohmer, House File 906. Representative Lohmer, according to what I have in front of me, your bill is, the next stop for that is Government Operations and Elections Policy. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 906.
Okay. And recommend that it be referred to the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee. Representative Lohmer, go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you so much for hearing House File 906 today. This is a very important bill with the goal of preventing private citizens and public officials from being afraid to report a crime to law enforcement. We need to protect our citizens that are performing their civic duty. No one should ever be afraid to be a good citizen, and that is exactly what happened to two of my constituents. They're here to tell their story today and ask that we fix this problem with House File 906.
Thank you, Representative Lohmer. Which testifier is going first?
Keith Mueller.
Okay, go ahead, Keith, and represent, or please state your name for the record.
Sure. Keith Mueller. Thank you, Madam Chair, fellow committee members. Obviously, my name's Keith Mueller. I'm going to just take you away from this for just a minute. I'm going to ask you to just indulge me because I want you to go back and feel what we went through so that it brings it home. I'd like you to imagine yourself seeing a person you think is committing a crime. You do the right thing and you report it. You truthfully cooperate with the police investigation, which ultimately results in the accused person being charged. Now, imagine how you'd feel when just days after his citation, your spouse has served a lawsuit against you in district court, alleging bogus allegations for $150,000 or more just for being a witness and cooperating with law enforcement. Despite this lawsuit, you're subpoenaed. You testify at his criminal trial, and a jury convicts the man beyond a reasonable doubt. Your nightmare continues. With the help of his attorneys, the convicted man piles on additional charges in district court just days after his conviction. As if that's not enough, he actually goes so far as filing a federal lawsuit against you. It's deemed so frivolous that the federal judge summarily dismissed it and canceled the hearing, something I later learned is very rare. The lawsuit continues, unfortunately, in district court. Your phone records, emails are scrutinized, while the convicted man subpoenas your doctor, your employer, and even seeks subpoenas against your wife and your priest. These scorched earth tactics impugn your professional life, which is tarnished by these empty accusations. Your licensing authorities are forced to place you on probation until the baseless charges are dropped or dismissed. Reputational worries aside, your life is scrutinized and financial concerns mount, while sleepless nights contribute to physical ailments. At times, the emotional stress is gut-wrenching and almost more than you can bear. You're the witness, yet you feel like you're the one on trial. Your nightmare finally ends after 2 years and roughly $150,000 in legal fees. And in the end, your attorneys tell you you won and you should be happy. You're not. Sound far-fetched? Well, it's not, because this is exactly what happened to me, and it could happen to any one of you. Tell me, after going through all of this, would you get involved the next time you see something suspicious, or would you turn your head and ignore it? You know, when you're sued, life's normal challenges just don't cease. You have to deal with life, but you also have to deal with something as invasive as a lawsuit like this. I lost faith in our legal system. I remember telling my wife, this can't be what our legislature had in mind. So this bill, HF 906, is the culmination of my two-year odyssey to rectify the problems we encountered during this mess. And speaking here today fulfills a promise I made to my wife after learning I'd been sued in federal court. I vowed that I'd do what I could to prevent what happened to me from happening to any one of you, your family, or your friends. Without this legislation, there could be a chilling effect on the public from stepping forward and performing their civic duty. I'll be available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next testifier, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Steve Bonin. Like Keith, I'm here today to serve the citizens of Minnesota by supporting changes that will benefit everyone cooperating with law enforcement. I will share my personal experiences regarding the immunity laws that failed us. I, like most of the people in this room, decided to step forward and become a public servant. I wanted to give something back to my community. During my campaign, many citizens stepped forward to help. On the fateful day of October 4th, 2010, my world changed forever. Keith called me to inform me that one of my large campaign signs, with the rebar still attached, was bouncing up and down, unsecured, on the roof of a SUV while driving down Highway 96. Keith followed the SUV into a bike trail parking lot, intending to take a photo of the vehicle to document the suspicious and unsafe event. The man in the SUV, instead of securing the loose sign, charged at Keith's vehicle in a threatening manner, shouting profanities at him. Hearing the grave concern in Keith's voice, I called the sheriff to report the incident. I later discovered that the sign Keith spotted was actually one of many taken from a supporter's yard without their permission. Shortly after receiving his ticket for disorderly conduct and theft, the man in the SUV sued me, the sheriff, and Keith, the victim of his disrespectful threats. Even after receiving his guilty verdict by a jury of six, the man in the SUV continued his relentless hunt, holding everyone but himself accountable for his illegal activities. It took 3.5 years and thousands of hours of expensive legal defense to ultimately prevail against the frivolous claims made by the man in the SUV. The law should have given me the immediate protection and remedies that we all expect when aiding law enforcement, but it didn't. I'm here to inform you that instead of firing straight and true, our immunity laws, when put to the test, will blow up in your face. The collateral damage to me and my family because of the lack of protection afforded to those who aid law enforcement is incomprehensible. 4 years of overwhelming legal distractions compromised my ability to be a good father, a husband, a businessman, a councilman, and a road commissioner. Currently, I am separated from my wife and devoted partner of 22 years. I cannot stress enough the pressures that come with this type of legal attack. I owe in excess of $1 million in legal expenses defending this fiasco. As written, 554 and 604 don't work. Please support Representative Lohmer in her efforts to improve the immunity protections for our citizens by passage of HF 906. And thank you for your public service.
Thank you for that riveting testimony. Representative Lohmer, are there any other testifiers here today?
Yes, we do have James Frank from the Minnesota Sheriff.
Wonderful. Please come
Franklin,
forward.
Excuse me.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I'll be brief and concise. I've been in law enforcement for over 45 years. I have never seen a case such as this. Secondly, we in law enforcement depend on the most valuable asset that we have in our community, and that's our citizens. They provide us with the tools, the information to solve crimes. We are very dependent upon them. When we saw this case, when we got involved with this case through the lawsuit, we filed an amicus brief on this particular case from the standpoint that no citizen doing their civic duty to report suspicious or criminal activity should have to be involved in this type of a situation. We had thought with the two statutes that were in place that this would not occur. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm told that the legal language that's before you now will clarify and eliminate this from occurring again. My final comment is we need to protect our citizens who are coming forth presenting information that they believe is credible, legal, and doing the right thing to protect our community and other citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. I see another testifier at the table. Go ahead and introduce yourself on the tape, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Hill, and I'm with my co-counsel, Sharon Van Dyke. I'm a friend of Steve Bonin's. I've had 29 years of litigation experience, and I got out of the practice for all the reasons that you've just heard about 10 years ago. I do property tax for a living. But I'm the one that received the call from Steve, actually before the lawsuit. The day after the gentleman was charged, he had a lawyer write to Steve and say, either you remove all your, quote, illegal signs immediately, or we will bring the wrath of God down on you. I kind of laughed at that email because I said, Steve, thank God we still have the First Amendment. 10 days later, I was served with a 28-page complaint with allegations I'd never seen before in 29, well, at that point, 25 years of litigation. I'd never seen accusing my client of fraud, civil conspiracy with a sheriff, malicious prosecution. It just went on and on and on. And the fact of the matter is that the reason we're here in front of you is that we have too many immunity statutes. And by that I mean the problem with the SLAPP statute as currently enacted is it doesn't spell out specifically that when you report suspected criminal activity to law enforcement, that is public participation. Any lawyer would tell you that the definition that's already in the statute does cover this activity. In fact, my co-counsel, Ms. Van Dyke, is a very, very, very well-regarded appeals lawyer. And we cited to 18 different states, all with SLAPP statutes that aren't as inclusive as ours. Ours, believe it or not, is the model statute. It's considered the model statute nationwide. But here's the rub. roughly 10 years after it was enacted, we enacted a specific statute just for citizen reporting. And what happens in the court system, particularly when you have silk-stocking lawyers on the other side, is they convince the judges that because the legislature acted after the SLAPP statute was enacted, that somehow it doesn't protect the conduct. In other words, you have two statutes to address the same mischief. What this bill does is it gets rid of that fibrillation in our statute and brings it all back home where it belongs in the first place, which is the SLAPP statute. Our SLAPP statute would have stopped this in its tracks 4 years ago, long before Mr. Bonin had to endure a 10-hour deposition and be called a liar, long before Mr. Mueller had to endure a 6-hour deposition and basically be impliedly called a liar. This has affected a great many people's lives. And the tragedy of it all is that our model statute has not been construed by our courts the way it should have been. If we clean this statute up now, that will never happen again to anybody else in this room. I ran for office myself and I had my sign stolen. I think all of you probably know what that's like. It's actually just a fact of life in your business. That I'm sure of. But what is not a fact of life in anybody's life is that a well-heeled criminal can turn his legal resources and his ability to write checks to well-heeled lawyers and just basically ignore the facts and the law altogether. And without any damages, the guy had his day in court, he was found guilty, and that's when the disaster started. This bill corrects that, and I strongly urge that the committee pass it.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, are there questions? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And wow, I don't even know where to start with this. Normally, in a situation like this, my first reaction would be, because this sounds pretty bad, I would want to hear from the other side, this guy or his lawyer or whoever he is, and I doubt he's here. And then second is, when we craft a law in response to a single situation, it makes me wonder how many other situations are we applying this to? And I can't really get that information without finding out what in the world is the story with this guy. So my first question would be, who is this guy? What's this guy's name?
I don't know who wants to answer that.
I mean, it's on the record. He was convicted in a public court, so it's public record.
Mr. Hill.
I'm going to probably get in trouble, but that's my nature. His name is Jeffrey Lynn Nielsen. He's been involved at least in 30 to 40 lawsuits that we're aware of. There is a reporter in the room, Elizabeth Moore, who's been covering the story from day one and actually did a really good article on March 29th of 2013 documenting. There are people in the world that are serial filers. And unfortunately, the guy that was stealing the signs and then acting in a disorderly way towards Mr. Mueller is one of them. So in their world, they can never be held accountable because they got the money to take care of any problem. And they count on the fact that the system will never catch up to them. As I was mentioning, Madam Chair, Representative Latz, we cited 18 different, I may have had your name wrong.
It's okay. It's a long story, Mr. Hill. Don't even worry about it. That's
yeah,
okay.
And I can't, and I don't have my contacts in. But the bottom line is, Representative Lash, we cited 18 different states where reporting crime is covered by the SLAPP statute. As I said, our definition covers it, but because we had this fibrillation, this other statute, basically what our court said is, look, the legislature must have intended that it didn't cover reporting of crime, or they would have never had to enact this other statute. The truth is that other statute occurred because of a single occurrence where a guy was driving down 35W and saw a guy swerving and thought he was drunk, called 911. The guy got stopped, didn't get charged, got the 911 tape, and sued the guy for defamation. And the representative in that case was outraged in South Minneapolis. And so that bill went through this legislature like corn through a goose. Unfortunately, there were no hearings. There was no discussion as to whether or not we needed a separate statute. Quite frankly, what should have been done then is what we're doing now. They should have just amended the SLAPP statute then. The SLAPP statute's a very powerful statute, but it's also very arcane. And I will be the first to tell you, as an officer of the court, judges have a tough time with it, because what it does, and what it would have done in this case, is it would have stopped discovery, and it would have forced the criminal to prove up an intentional tort, all these allegations he's making, without the benefit of discovery, by clear and convincing evidence, something he could not have done. And that's why the statute's so important, and that's why we think that the legislature needs to amend it to spell out explicitly what's already implicit in the statute.
Representative Lesch. Well,
thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that description. Mr. Hill, by the way, it's Lesch.
Thank you. There we go.
It's not that you mispronounced it, it's how you mispronounced it. So, you know.
We're all one big happy family.
Yeah, we are. So my question is, this guy, Jeffrey Lynn Nielsen, I'm going to have to go read the articles that were done by the reporter, because I am interested now in who this guy is. I'm interested in hearing the other side, because the story that you told me gets my blood boiling about how someone can actually use the system that I prize, over which I've raised my hand and taken an oath to defend on the federal level of military, on the state level of the legislature, and on the local level as a prosecutor multiple times, that someone could take that system that I respect and use it to systematically persecute individuals, if that's in fact what it is. Normally I wouldn't use that word without hearing the other side. And so it makes me question also the attorneys or officials that he has employed to do this as well.
Right.
Without hearing the other side, my first reaction is serious professional misconduct. So I'm wondering what the options are there as well. But I'm probably going far afield.
No, you're not, Representative Lesch. I will tell you, we can send you the brief that my esteemed colleague submitted yesterday. We, in the end, because the SLAPP statute, because we were told we couldn't use the SLAPP statute, which automatically not only puts a stop to it, but also allows people like Keith and Steve to get compensatory and punitive damages against the perpetrator. Very powerful statute. But because we were told we couldn't use it, we resorted to the common law, and we have a case pending in front of Judge Sipkins in Hennepin County against Mr. Nielsen and his teams of lawyers under both an abusive process and malicious prosecution and a conspiracy claim. So your point is very well taken, and if you wish, we can submit the briefs we just filed. They're quite telling and quite damning, and we're not going to let him get away with it.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I would just close by saying, you know what, I appreciate that, and you know, again, I hesitate to weigh in without hearing the other side, but unless Jeffrey Lynn Nielsen is here, or any of his attorneys are here who are not coming forward to say anything, I guess I'll wish you the best in that. Hopefully some measure of justice can be achieved through those means.
Thank you. Representative Pintle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I look at this certainly seems to make a lot of sense. I did want to ask, I assume that you got attorney fees paid in this case, is that right? Because 604A.34, which I guess would apply to this, says reasonable attorney. So I understood that discovery goes through, it's painful along the way, but at least did you get attorney fees in the case?
Mr. Mueller.
Yes, I was awarded immunity under 604. I was granted attorney's fees in district court only. The federal charge that was lodged in sister litigation to this, so when we had alleged SLAPP, that put a stay that Bob was just referring to on. So he didn't like that. He went around the stay and filed a federal charge against us regarding a Data Privacy Protection Act. Okay. For that, we wrote one brief. It cost me $24,000. The judge dismissed it without even having it go to hearing, and I'm not able to recover that unless I sue my own, take on my own litigation against him, which at this point, you know, with all the emotion and the drag that went with this, including at my work, I didn't want to go through anymore.
Representative Pennell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been a while since I practiced in federal court, but I guess I'm surprised with such a frivolous suit that you wouldn't get attorney fees at the federal level.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Thank you. I was. We asked for sanctions, which was what we could do, and the judge, admitted that this was sanctionable conduct, but refused to give us sanctions for a variety of reasons. One in particular, I guess the main reason was that this was so frivolous that in her mind it never should have even come to her desk. So in her view, it ends right here. We all walk away. And it didn't end. It just kept on going.
If I may comment, Representative Pinto.
Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bonin never did get attorney's fees because he was not required to testify at the criminal trial. The state court judge said the good faith requirement under 604A is not something that is subject to summary disposition. So we were headed to trial to prove up Steve's good faith. And I call it the tag team effect. What Mr. Nielsen did is he had one team of lawyers bring the complaint. They withdrew. We didn't give the safe harbor, if you know what that Rule 11 requires, a 21-day safe harbor. So the guys that filed the complaint withdrew. A new team of lawyers came on. They didn't file the complaint, and so we didn't get sanctions either. We couldn't even file the safe harbor. And then, tragically enough, in the state court case, after they realized the jig was up, they had no damages. This was a criminal. And so they withdrew. He hired a third team of lawyers. They dismissed one of the two claims, and the judge finally said, you know what, I made a mistake in not getting rid of the abusive process claim, so guess what? Bonin never got his trial on 604A, and we never got paid. And I will just say, I'm not a mercenary, neither is Ms. Van Dyke. We're in this for the long haul, whether we get paid a dime or not. But I will tell you this. If you don't enact a statute that protects these guys, you're going to have a heck of a time finding lawyers that are willing to fight for what's right. And that's a collateral thing to this, but it is a real thing. And in Mr. Bonin's case, it has caused enormous emotional distress. I know. I get the emails.
Thank you. Mr. Mueller, it sounds like you have a comment.
I do. Thank you. Madam Chair, when I got involved in this, I knew what I was getting into. And I had just been through 2 years of hell. And I knew it was going to be tough getting into this spot. But that said, I'm even leery here today to provide testimony for fear that people are watching and listening from based on everything I went through. It shouldn't be that way. I believe that there's evil out there. I believe that there are guys that are going to do what they do, but I really do hold the responsibilities on the attorneys. I believe that they should have reined in people and done the due diligence that anti-SLAPP makes you do. In other words, with 604A, the current statute that we use, any one of you can make an allegation against me, and I have to defend it. Okay, I have to hire an attorney. We have to respond with a brief, and all the attorneys know how that works. Under anti-SLAPP, it said, well, wait a minute. You know what? This seems to have a pattern of harassment. Looks like you're trying to really inflict some harm on this. We're going to immunize this guy right up front, unless you can prove to us that his cooperation and testimony constituted a tort, that this guy's cooperation was not in good faith. And if indeed that happens, then I lose immunity under anti-SLAPP. And I know it gets confusing. Anti-SLAPP here, 604 here. What we're really trying to do is I did speak with the people that did bring 604 into legislation, and they admit that they didn't know anti-SLAPP existed. And right now, the judicial system is looking at this case and all of these cases, and they're confused. They don't understand where they are on this, and the plain language of the statute is written broadly, but it's enacted extremely narrowly. And in fact, if I remember correct, in the appellate decision that Bob was representing and sharing for Mr. Bonin, the judges came back and said, anti-SLAPP's never been applied to a case like this. Its typical application has been against real estate and property developers or abuses therein. here's the problem I've got. Why are people that are abused because a property development is being put in and you're trying to oppose it, and then big guns come in and say, if you don't get out of our way, we're going to sue you. Why are they afforded more protections than the guy like me that's trying to cooperate with the police? And knowing what was about to come down because of letters that were being sent, I still cooperated. I didn't change my testimony. I did go through the trial, and at every step of the way, it got worse. And so all we're trying to do in this particular situation is ask you, do you believe someone who's credibly cooperating with law enforcement should be provided and awarded the most protections available by law? And that right now is anti-SLAPP. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller, and I can't imagine what y'all have gone through. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and not so much a question as, and I'm sorry I'm late, I had a sick kid and the roads were terrible. But, so if you covered this already, but it sounds like some of this is tantamount to witness intimidation. And so if anybody's having any issues with this particular piece of legislation, I just have you look at it that way, because if we can't get people, I mean, you probably would be curious if you'd really actually call, knowing that that person committed a crime, to report it in the future. And secondly, we do, we afford public officials, especially law enforcement, it's not exactly apples to apples, but, you know, some protections in this area as well, too, because, you know, it was not uncommon for our profession to be hit with frivolous lawsuits, just frivolous liens on property and all those things, just to make it more difficult. And I think that this is probably something that's overdue in correcting maybe a mistake that happened a while back. If this is, kind of sounds like that's the case, it was maybe something that was overlooked or missed when it was originally drafted. And so I hope that we can fix that, because, I mean, we talk about this all the time. We do things in law, I mean, we're talking about making sure that citizens or non-citizens are not afraid to call the police, because we want them first and foremost to get the help that they need. And so if we have to correct this to make sure that that's the case.
Mr. Mueller.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. There's only one difference between the two. In the current statute as we've got it now, or in the proposed bill, right now you've got 604, you've got anti-SLAPP. We kind of know through the chart and the information I gave you what that's about. The only difference that you're going to see that's in 604 that isn't in the new one is the word good faith. And the only reason that was put out is because these guys, including myself, had to go to trial or write briefs to prove that good faith existed. And it was, to me, I hate using the term paralysis by overanalysis, but, you know, I mean, the sheriff just corroborated, and so did the jury, corroborated the testimony. And yet you still have to go through all that? So the plain language of anti-SLAPP says speech or lawful conduct that is genuinely aimed at in whole or in part at procuring favorable government outcome or action. Speech or lawful conduct. So lawful conduct is the key there. It's like good faith. You know, if you try and make a bad faith report to law enforcement, as Mr. Franklin will testify or say, you know, you can be charged with a misdemeanor for filing a false charge. In this particular situation, again, it makes the attorneys do more due diligence with anti-SLAPP, with that suspension of stay. That's the key in this whole thing. That suspension and stay makes the attorneys take a step back, really do their homework, and now all of a sudden, instead of just throwing a bunch of stuff at the fan, now they have to prove that you actually did something wrong. And if they can do that, then my immunity is lost, and we're right back where we started with 604.
And Madam Chair,
Mr. Hill.
Representative Schoen, you're spot on. The problem we have as lawyers is good faith is treated by our courts, particularly our Supreme Court, as an inherently subjective test. What is good faith? And that problem is not in the SLAPP statute for one simple reason. The presumption is that you acted in good faith when you spoke to the police. And so if they have clear and convincing evidence that you made it up, they can bring that forward and they still have their due process rights protected. But you don't put the onus on the innocent to prove up something that is obvious. And that's the problem with the way 604A was drafted, is they put in the good faith requirement with good intentions. You don't want people making up lies to the cops and then claiming immunity. We all get that. But the problem in litigation is those two words can cost you $1 million in legal fees to fight about. And that's what happened to Mr. Bonin.
Mr. Hill, you have a colleague there with you. Was there anything that she wanted to add to the conversation?
I was hoping. Her name is Sharon Van Dyke, and she is a dream come true.
Okay.
That's scary.
Yeah, go ahead and get closer to the mic there. Introduce yourself for the tape, and if you have a few words, that would be great.
Thank you. My name is Sharon Van Dyke, and I'm one of Mr. Bonin's attorneys, and I came in, you know, partway through this disaster. And I just wanted to tell you that the impact this has on people's lives is unbelievable, and it sounds so stupid when you start. And people called me and said, we're up to here in litigation, here being high. And it's costing, you know, my client $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, and it's all about a guy driving down the road and reporting seeing a guy with a sign on his roof. I didn't take it seriously. I've done all the appellate work. I'm the one that's been struggling with all the language you're talking about. It's absolutely necessary to protect innocent people. I also wanted to let you know that I'm past president of Minnesota Association for Justice, MAJ, and we are taking this up in our executive committee meeting to approve this. Usually we're anti-immunity, as you probably know, but this is an abuse. This is an absolute abuse. And the lawyers who allow themselves to sell their licenses, which is the way I view it, they allow a crazy guy, powerful, big spender, crazy guy, to use the law, use the court system to beat people up. And they do it because they're crazy, they love power, they're bullies, and they have one heck of a lot of money. And their lawyers that they hire, and Mr. Hill talked about serial violator, this guy has serial lawyers. We've been doing the research, it's all over the country. And they're all big firms, and they all charge way more than any of us do. And they're getting paid. And just because Mr. Bonin hasn't gotten attorney's fees, do you know, if you're an honest person, the guilt you feel if you can't pay your bills, the stress that puts you under, this is just meant to make it right. And that's what we're trying to do.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Bonin, do you have some final comments there?
Madam Chair, the only comment that I would like to make is that if you want to feel the gravity of what this has created, the skepticism that this has created in all our minds that are involved in this, when we were asked to announce the name of the person, the chilling effect that you saw amongst lawyers and representatives afraid to mention a criminal's name will just give you a little idea of the chilling effect that this has on your public. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. And you know, I'm sorry for taking us there on that. Well, no, I'm not sorry. I'm sorry for the effect that it had. I talked with Representative Lomer about this on the floor yesterday, and I told her I was, because I had heard about this guy. But I also want to know the names of these lawyers, too. Now, I know you can't go down the list of them, but I want to know who they are, and I'd like to know if the reporter or there have been any news stories that have listed the names of these individuals.
Who wants to take a stab at that?
I'll take a stab at it. Sharon Van Dyke here. And I admit we're nervous too. But the second lawsuit that is referenced in the brief that Mr. Hill referenced, that's a public lawsuit. It's filed in Hennepin County. And anybody can go look at it that they want. And the names of the caption on that case is Stephen Bonin versus George Eck and Dorsey and Whitney, Thomas Paul, P-A-H-L, and Foley and Mansfield.
and then you start following the cookie crumbs. But that's public record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Van Dyke. One final question. Has this Jeffrey Lynn Nielsen, he been using the same lawyers all the way through, or does he go through lists of them?
Ms. Van Dyke. We have, from doing research, all of which is public record. And the reason people don't know this is because it's taken us months, weeks, thousands of dollars to follow those cookie crumbs, going through court records from all over the country. We know for a fact that the two firms that are the defendant in the current case have represented him all over the place. And he changes them up. And he also uses other firms. Because as we said in the first state court action here, in which Mr. Mueller and Mr. Bonin and the County of Washington were all sued, they ended up being three. There was a third team brought in at the end. So he changes them up, but he kind of sticks with favorites. And they're big. They have offices all over the country. And they cost a lot of bucks an hour.
Thank you. Mr. Hill, did you have a comment?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Lesch. I told you I didn't like litigation, but I'm good at it. And I don't take prisoners. And when I found out years ago, as I hired a private investigator, I couldn't understand what was going on here. I'd never seen this before. And I got the whole list. And we've been going back slowly but surely and peeling the onion. I was shocked because I'd never seen this kind of misconduct by lawyers. As Ms. Van Dyke says, they really are selling their license for a fee. And the quid pro quo is, you do what I tell you to do, or I'll find somebody who will. I don't care what the law is. I don't care that I don't have any damages. I want my revenge, and I'm going to get it. And if you don't do it, I'll find somebody else who will. We're going to prove all that up in court in Hennepin County. I will tell you one good piece of news in this is that I made it a rule 25 years ago never to watch a legal show, so I never watched Law & Order. But because of this case, I watch Law & Order all the time now, because literally that's the only way we're going to bring this to justice, is to figure out and unwind that clock. And it is not easy. The threats are always there. They're still there today. I had a Rule 11 sanctions motion brought against me for having the audacity to file what amounts to a slapback suit in state court. It intimidates lawyers. It scares lawyers. And that's why the slap statute needs to be as strong as humanly possible, because it won't just empower the citizen, it will empower the lawyers to protect the citizens that they're supposed to be protecting anyway.
Thank you. Final comment, Ms. Van Dyke.
And this is important. One of the reasons we're having so much trouble peeling this onion is because even the lawyers who have been the ethical, upstanding lawyers who are protecting the people around the country that this gentleman sues and eventually win, and businesses, because this guy sues in his business context as well, those lawyers are afraid to give us any information from their files because they know he'll sue them. So they can't cooperate, except, or won't, some of them, except to point us to big stacks of legal papers and say, look to the right or look to the left. This man frightens lawyers as much as he frightens Steve Bonin and Keith Mueller. And this statute's supposed to fix that.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Lohmer, for bringing this bill forward. And I, again, so sorry for what has happened to Mr. Bonin and Mr. Mueller. The only saving grace here is that you've found some really committed attorneys here that are willing to work hard for you and come and bring some legislation forth that seems to be overdue. And I wish you the best in your endeavors going forward. I hope that justice really, truly is served. And it's heartbreaking to hear how it's affected your personal lives and your families. And just keep fighting the good fight. Thank you to your attorneys for being here to testify and for all the work they're doing. And with that, Representative Lohmer, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I really appreciate, again, the opportunity to be here with this bill, and just I'm so thankful that these folks brought it to my attention and that we could do something about it. I just want to say last Friday we had a little huddle before this to just talk about today, and when they were talking to me about the fact that they absolutely, Mr. Bonin absolutely never even consider being in any kind of public service position again, Mr. Mueller never wanting to report any crime again, it just broke my heart, and I'm sure you're all catching that, but I'm just really thankful and hopeful that we can fix this problem. So thank you, members and Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lomer. With that, Representative Lomer would renew her motion to move House File 906 and have it re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way to Government Operations and Election Policy. Thank you. And with that, members, we are adjourned.